this is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate your time. Good to be here again. All sorts of fun stuff happening, and I have an excuse to talk with Michael Grosso. Michael's got a fabulous background, some wonderful books, and some extraordinary experiences. But the book we're talking about today, just to kind of kick it off, is A Man Who Could Fly, a saint who could levitate. So we'll get into that. And then hopefully Michael will share with us some of the other things that he's experienced in his life. So first off, thank you. I appreciate your time. The book is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm pleased to hear that.
Well, okay. In terms of levitation, the stuff that people are fascinated by is it real? And how could that be? And it certainly seems like, given the experiences I'm aware of, that this was an anomaly that the church really, really was frightened of. And they had to allow it, but they kept a close watch on it. How did you get caught up in this story?
For a couple of reasons. One reason is that I discovered that Joseph has a tremendous sort of reputation among scholars as being one of the most well-documented cases of not only levitation, but a whole range of paranormal phenomena. And since I am, for years I've been interested in the philosophy of mind, it's my philosophical, background that is driving that. And discontented with the mainstream view, I'm not a materialist. I believe that materialism, so I understand how it came about as a philosophy, and it's sort of science-mediated and science-based, is simply not true. And there are many ways that could be argued, but one of the most obvious ways is to focus on the so-called paranormal phenomena, which by definition involves things that are seem to transcend the physical reality. So, for example, in the case of levitation, which is very dramatic, and that's another reason I like it, you have a connection that is very clear between a state of mind, namely an ecstatic state of mind, because all of the saints and all of the cases and yogis and whatnot that I've studied, where you have reports of this phenomenon, they are always preceded. Levitation is always preceded by an unusual state of mind. The best term to use to describe this is ecstasy, meaning, out of your normal self, completely swept up in the contemplation or the absorption in something outside of yourself. So there's a loss of any sense of yourself. I mean, we all have a touch of it, right? Listening to music, certain moments we're kind of lost. When we're in love, when we see a beautiful landscape, we kind of lose self-awareness and we drift off into the wonder of that thing that we are contemplating. And the mystics and the yogis sort of train themselves for these voyages. And what happens when they really push it far, as in case of someone like Joseph, every now and then you have these unusual physical phenomena, amongst which are levitation. So that's part of the background. The other part of the background, so I want to make this, I decided that I was going to take this famous case and really study it and write about it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that as far as levitation, I had an experiment myself, performed an experiment some years ago when I was a course in personality development, in which my colleague, I team taught this course, and I, actually it was my idea, to try an experiment of levitation. Some of the students had talked about games that they played when they were children, called Light as a Feather. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was, okay, I'm going to get this big, heavy ex-Marine, weighed about 200 pounds. I sat him down, and then I selected four of the frailest, shall we say. I don't want to use that word frail to put him down, but, young women. Mm-hmm. And they each of them put their two fingers underneath each leg and under the elbows. There was no pressure involved. And we had been meditating together and chanting together. So I got them to get into a state of sort of a unified mind.
Yeah.
And had them chant a few words and then said, lift. And lo and behold, it happened. And I heard, it surprised me. I didn't expect it to happen. When I saw this huge guy go up in the air, and these young ladies, they're not making any effort. They're just holding, and they're looking. They're as astonished as I am and as the Marine was. And
I'm sure he was,
Right back down. I'll never forget the expression on his face of utter astonishment. So this is in front of a whole class. And as far as I'm concerned, it was a case of levitation because the physical, there was no physical pressure, just the contact. A little bit like touching in a marker in a Ouija board experiment. I don't know if you know what I'm referring to there.
Tipping or that kind of stuff, yeah.
You just touch it and sometimes it'll move.
Right.
But of course, when a little light thing moves, that's one thing. But when a 200-pound Marine gets elevated into the air, that is a far more profound experience. So that's the background. And when I got my hands on this biography some years ago on a trip to Italy, I decided to have it translated and write a book. And so I did, and that's what we're talking about today.
Well, so you've had that experience, but you had some other experiences that had to give you a little bit more appreciation for what was happening here, because in retrospect, going back, there were some considerable psychic phenomena that were a part of this whole thing, because at the same time, there were other, the female saint that is also under scrutiny at that time is being watched closely by the church. These are things that they know are happening, and they're not quite sure how to shut it down. But there was also at that time a lot of persecution of people who had these abilities who weren't affiliated with the church.
Well, right. There was the church's concern was that if a person exhibits these abilities, who's giving them the power? From my point of view, these are natural phenomena, and they don't require any divine intervention. But in Joseph's time, there was only two options. Either this was God who was intervening and disrupting the laws of nature to make a point, or it was some kind of diabolic intervention. The assumption was that the diabolic agencies could pull off the same tricks, so to speak, that the Almighty can.
Yeah.
So it was important to determine that whoever demonstrated these abilities to make it clear by interviewing them and sometimes really persecuting them, discovering what their motivation was, and to make sure that they were not involved in any kind of magical hanky panky, and that it was pure, a byproduct of their spiritual practice.
Well,
so Joseph was twice dragged in front of the Inquisition and had to defend himself.
Yes. Yeah, and that part.
And the women, and yes, by the way, the women ditto. I mean, St. Teresa, for example, who was a much more, let's say, intellectually evolved saint than St. Joseph, and more active, she was an organizer. She had many experiences, but she prayed so hard for them to stop because they were an embarrassment that they did stop. But in the case of Joseph, he did the same thing. He prayed and got his fellow brethren to pray with him to end these phenomena, which he admitted felt nice. He's admit that. But he failed. This went on to his practically the last day of his life. On his deathbed, he levitated. So this is an utterly unusual case. I mean, it was a force that he could not control, and that makes it all the more fascinating.
Okay, and if you're listening now, the book There are lots of websites with this information, but the book draws a lot of the modern stuff, like other people who've had out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences. Joseph McMonagle, who I've interviewed him before, talking about what he experienced with a near-death experience. There are some names that you drop here that are present-day writers, authors, scholars, scientists, you know, people who've had experiences with paranormal events, who also can kind of give us, I think, a greater appreciation for this stuff being normal and real, where at that point, it was still very much, you were ostracized if this kind of stuff happened. And to that point...
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that that's somewhat of an overstatement. Not ostracized. You had to pass muster. You were, let's say, scrutinized by the church. And once they... You know, and the reason that I think there was a fear of someone who could walk around and perform miracles and do amazing stuff could be a challenge to the authority of the church, start his own little movement. And that was the chief concern.
Yeah, there was one of the guys who was really jealous and said he was mimicking Jesus and he should be shut down. He complained.
Yes. That's right. That was one of the early people, and pretty early on in his career, he created some enemies, partly out of envy, and there was an early phase of his career when, you know, he had this ability to read people's minds, and so he would just walk into a crowd and he'd say, "Hey, you're thinking about eating dinner when you was the other night when you were praying. That's not right." I mean, I'm giving him like a very harmless little example, but the point was it was obnoxious. So that his fellow monks said, "Hey, go easy with that. Be a little more sophisticated and don't come crashing into people's lives and, you know, accusing them of these little peccadilloes or..." Because you could read everybody's mind. So he kind of cooled out. He chilled out, and he would say things like, you should aim more clearly now. And he wouldn't come right out and just accuse someone of something. So he got a little more sophisticated as time went
There's
on.
One point in the book where these
I'm
ladies
not sure
come
if I would
to
like
church. There was a couple, there was right, the ladies right. come to church, and that one you talk about where he, they had intended to say a couple of words that would put him into that ecstatic state and he would, you know, lift. And they had that intention and they got a round of applause. So they planned it. And the minute they showed up at his church, he turned around and spoke to them and said, "You're just here to, you're just curious, get out." And she's the woman.
Oh, yes.
Book
yes.
was like, oh, mortified.
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. He did have an ad. Well, he didn't like, and I can understand, he didn't like being a freak show.
Yeah.
I mean, he understood that the nature of his experiences was strange and baffling and a byproduct of his ecstatic state. And so many people came in awe of his reputation as a holy man. Some came simply, you know, to gape and be turned on and amused by something strange and bizarre. And when he sensed that in this item that you allude to, it's a specific case history, he catches them out and says, you know, if you're here just to watch some kind of a show, go someplace else. I'm not, that's not what I'm about. You see.
What I find fascinating, the state that he was in where it caused him to be incredibly insecure and self-doubting. And if, you know, you get into the chakra stuff, that's like a third chakra issue of self-esteem. And then other issues that go along with that would also go along with his body, his body issues of being incredibly, shall we say, ungrounded. And he maintained that state, which he also said that was probably the thing that helped.
Right. No, he was definitely, he had a sense of, after people were doubting him and challenging him for his motives, and they wanted to make sure, you know, where he was coming from, being a sensitive guy and being aware of himself and trying to master himself, he did undergo periods of doubt as to his, validity of his project, so to speak.
The source.
Natural for any, anybody. I mean, a creative writer, a painter, an artist. I mean, there are always moments of doubt, right? That's perfectly natural. And he, you know, had to, but in the end, you see, he passed muster with the Inquisition, and the majority of the people who knew him supported him. But there are, you know, there are always strangers out there that don't know you and maybe get jealous or just have malice. And so that was part of his life. It's like the part of the life of any highly creative human being. You run into challenges.
Well, he seemed to keep...
In the end, he mastered himself.
Incredibly, he kept himself incredibly focused and very devout. And in so many ways, anytime the money issue came into it, absolutely no way, refuse, approve. You can't buy this. And I think that was also part of his a way of keeping himself unattached or detached from the corporeal or physical need for some kind of reward that was a material. A recognition of material, you know, achievement.
Right. Well, you know, he was a Franciscan, and his hero was Saint Francis of Assisi. And you know, Francis of Assisi had this romance with Lady Poverty. You know, they like to personify virtues, and the idea of people coming to him and saying. On several occasions, he was offered money to help, you know, basically to help the church. These are poor people in a poor part of Europe, but he wouldn't have any part of it. And to the point where both his church brethren and even his family would say, "What's wrong with you? We are hungry. We are needy. Can't you accept these gifts not for yourself, but just for, you know, for the monastery or for the family?" And couldn't do that. He would have no part. Let's put it this way. If we were all even slightly like Joseph, capitalism would die on the spot. It would be the end. Because he represents, like, I like to think of him as a kind of saint of anti-consumerism.
Yeah.
But needless to say, he carried it to wild extremes. You know, scarcely ate. He had maybe one monk's robe at a time. He liked to walk around barefoot. If anyone gave him anything, he would immediately give it away to someone else. He couldn't stand the idea of owning anything.
Well, at the beginning, when he wears the hair shirt, and then he puts nails and other things on to make, you know, to remind himself that he is an aesthete. You know, he doesn't want any kind of a comfort. He doesn't, he's like, no, don't make
exactly.
This.
Well, yeah, I mean, like many, many, many yogis and saints throughout history, was an extreme ascetic. And I believe that people who hear about this, they think, this, you know, what's wrong? He's crazy. It's not crazy at all.
No.
It has to do with the fact that to become an ascetic is a way of detaching yourself from everything. All physical sensations, physical needs, desires, goodies, and so forth. But not to torture himself, but to clear himself, to open himself up to something which, from the point of view of the saint or the yogi or the shaman, is infinitely more important, namely some kind of spiritual illumination. And which gave him more joy and more pleasure and a more solid basis of happiness than the ordinary material things that most people rely on for their sense of well-being. So, he was an extremist.
Yeah,
there's
well,
no doubt about it.
He also had a different perception, as you describe it, in bits and pieces, where he was able, when he was in that state, that out-of-body, more consciously aware state, he could see things that other people couldn't, that were, for him, much more real, because he could also see this state and then transcend that. And so that gave him, I think, a perspective of what lies beyond. And you write about that in a different book when you're talking about your own experiences of basically being able to see beyond this plane into the next plane. And it's not nearly after death as much as it is during death and beyond death in my way of viewing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not sure what other book you're referring to at the moment of mine. But yeah, I have talked about these things. And I think the difference between a contemporary approach to this and the more traditional case histories of extremists is precisely this, more balanced approach, I think, that we moderns, even the most pious Catholics nowadays, you rarely hear of them going off into solitary retreats and total self-abnegation. But the potential to have these experiences are available, and that we don't have to go to such wild sort of self-mutilating extremes to achieve them all the time. I can make sense out of this in terms of my own life.
Well, the experience now, the book that I was trying to, Experiencing the Next World Now.
Yes. That's a book about life after death. And, what I tried to do in that book was say, and this is still an idea that I strongly espouse, that I think it's possible for ordinary people to, maybe by through meditation or fasting or any number of kinds of procedures or practices, to tune in to a transcendent reality now, before we actually die, to get glimpses of that higher reality. That, people have near-death experiences. One of the points I make in my book is that, in a sense, Joseph used his spiritual practices to achieve what many near-death experiences achieve almost immediately by undergoing a cardiac arrest, for example, having a heart attack.
Yeah.
But an ordinary healthy person, not near death, who has the same spiritual ambitions, goes about it in a more subtle and gradual way, through fasting, through meditating, through controlling the mind, clearing the mind of all its distractions, and so on. So that book, that was the point of my book, that, it's great to have specific, and I do list all of the different kinds of evidence for life after death. I don't list them. I give case histories and examples in that book. But mediumistic, near-death experiences, apparitions of the dead, and so on and so forth. But what I try to say is that even if those things don't happen, it is possible to tune in to the transcendent realm of being through art, through music, meditation, through maybe making love, through getting lost in the beauties of nature. There are many ways. There's a whole universe of pathways open to all of us, I believe, if we're interested, if we have that motivation. If, on the other hand, we're just constantly thinking about more mundane matters, and for many of us, that's inevitable because we're just struggling to survive, let's say, we're not aware of all that other stuff that's out there. But some of us become aware, and sometimes in the course of life, events force us to confront our higher potentialities. And when that happens, sometimes we undergo changes. That was the point of Experiencing the Next World Now.
What I wanted to get and draw into that, given my own experiences with some of this stuff, and I'll refer to a blog experience you talk about in the next break. But the part of this is that I believe that Joseph, even though at points it would appear that he was locked into what would very much be considered a cell that only had light maybe half of the year, and so he had to have a candle there, and he stayed there and was quite happy.
Right.
But he was traveling. He was he was doing exactly what the out-of-body people do now, the near-death experiencers, once they've figured out the corporeal is just a part of this reality. And that's what he was doing, and not have been able to tell people because they might not understand it since they couldn't get past the levitation issue.
Absolutely. I'm convinced that is the case. And he was at, you know, there's a saying in the Upanishads, sitting still, he travels very far. Okay. The suggestion being that just by sitting and meditating, the mind can travel and experience all kinds of levels and grades of reality and beauties and wonders that are beyond anything that we can encounter with our sense life. So that is true. And he used to call it his, it was like a forest. He called his little room there, as you rightly point out, where there was scarcely any light half of the year, his forest paradise. So you got to be really deeply into your imagination, into your spiritual imagination.
Okay, we've got to take a break.
And you're visionary. Yeah, but to be able to say something like that.
All right, hold on. We'll take a break.
Most of us would just... Okay.
We'll be back. Michael Fongrosso in just a minute, and we're going to talk a little bit more about what happens when you're in that kind of state. And it gets exciting and interesting, and anybody can do it. Wendy's Coffee House. Listen to that, too. Okay, we're going to get Michael there, too.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a Labish Terrier Hound Chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that 4-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Today might be the day I drop out of school, but you might be able to stop me. With United Way, you could tutor me, be my mentor, or volunteer to just read with me. There are tons of ways people like you can help kids like me stay in school. Make me a success, not a statistic.
Take the pledge to volunteer now at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Check out my new time machine.
Does it work?
Hit the button.
Hey, it's Napoleon.
Oui. Check out the future.
Hey, you have a nice house. Why don't I?
You didn't save any money, buddy.
If only there was a way I could go back in time and fix that.
Yeah.
Save something for the future. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Wendy, and I appreciate your time. Glad to have you along. This is some fascinating stuff, levitation. If you had never heard about the saint, the man who could fly. It's intriguing. And not only that, it's because the more we find out about the stuff that people are able to do, for example, the stuff that's coming out about the psychic spies and what they were doing with the CIA, and everybody made fun of Uri Geller because, oh, he was just full of it. And now they're saying, oh, my gosh, he's legit. It's about time. So these kinds of things are also addressed in the stuff that Michael has in the book on the man who could fly. And I wanted to just opportunity to, you know, to say what you have experienced beyond that levitation in the class personally that helped give you a little more confidence in exploring this story.
I've had a couple of I've had almost every type of experience at least once, almost. Not I've never had a near death experience. Although I've had a near-death dream, and I would definitely mention this as one of the life-changing experiences of mine. When I was a graduate student, I remember having an elaborate dream, and it's all written down in my book, one of my books. But the imagery of the dream culminated in me carrying a boat or up a hill, not carrying, hauling it by a rope. And the boat, it could also have been my a coffin. So it had a symbolism of travel and death at the same time. And as I'm climbing up this hill, suddenly the sun rose, and I can only describe the experience of the light. I mean, it was not ordinary light. It was a beautiful, soulful light that penetrated my heart in a way that was truly marvelous and transcendent. And I woke up from that dream. I think I was barely knew anything about this. This would have been before the near-death phenomenon became well known. Mm-hmm. But I never forgot it as being one of the high, it was like a joke. I mean, the high point of my life is in a dream about my own death. You know, like, really? But that was the high point. That was mind blowing, you see. So that was certainly one experience. But they're all, I've experienced a number of unusual PK phenomena. I've also experienced precognition. You know, precognition is one of the most baffling of all of the phenomena. And you may remember, I think it was 1981, that the President Reagan was almost assassinated.
Yes.
I was teaching philosophy at that time, and I had three dreams in a period of 1 week. In each dream, I saw the president being nearly assassinated. I saw him being shot. I saw him come down. I saw where he was shot. Those were the first two dreams. And on the third dream, I see him again, and he's naked from the waist up, beaming with health, from which I then deduced. I said, if this happens, he gets shot, he's going to recover. And lo and behold, about a week after the last dream of the three, I get a call from one of my students breathlessly telling me that the president has just been shot. And the first thing I remember saying, but he's not dead and he's not going to die, because I was convinced that my dream was going to tell the truth. And indeed, he did recover. And the doctors pointed out how healthy he must have been to have recovered from that gunshot, and I think it was in his shoulder or ribs or whatever, I'm not sure exactly. But that was a very striking dream. And I told it to my students in advance. I said, I've had three dreams in a row. I wouldn't be surprised if something happens. And lo and behold, it did happen. So I've had other precognitive dreams, but that was one of the most spectacular. And again, it's a mystery. How is it possible? How, you know, to know something before it's actually taken place. That's completely baffling.
The other tangential thing about that was James Brady, because he was the one who was disabled during that assassination attempt.
Right. And I
thought he was in a wheelchair. So, you know, that thing that you saw with the upper body being, you know, manifest in surviving, that's just fascinating.
Right. Right.
Okay, so the other thing, you have a blog, and doing my research for this, I found the blog, Consciousness Unbound. So if you're listening, check it out, because this is another fascinating angle. And you share an experience that has to do with an out-of-body experience. And this is something I also am familiar with, and I know other people who've done it, but it's still on the fringe and considered, you know, in some circles, just one of those little mumbo-jumbo New Age things that we talk about
right.
that really isn't real. And this stuff
isn't
real.
Right.
Yes. So I really liked it that you included it and said, hey, this is what happened. You want to share that?
Yeah, for sure. I guess you're talking about the one that I titled recent thing that I published.
A
visit from a lady at night. I had a nice title, I think.
Out of body night visit from a lady.
Right. This was a student of mine who she's an anthropologist, by the way, and an extremely one of the brightest women that I've ever had as a student. She's a married woman with three kids, and she told me that she had out of body experiences, and she said she couldn't make them happen, but when they did happen, she seemed to have the ability to go places and direct herself. So I said, just casually, I said, well, look, if it ever happens, next time it happens, you know, come pay me a visit. That's all I said, like a joke, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some weeks later, I woke up one morning. I have to sort of back up a little bit and tell you a couple of the details of the story. At the time, I used to practice the flute. I had taken up the flute as a little hobby, you know. And I had my music stand in one place by a bookshelf. And every day I would, especially in the morning, I would get up and put some music on the music stand and practice. So at that time I was just practicing and improvising. So one morning I woke up and I went to, you know, grab my flute after I had breakfast, and I noticed that the music stand was right in the middle of the living room. And I said to myself, wow, what am I doing? I didn't do that. And after a while, I thought, well, I had to have unconsciously moved it, because there's nobody in the house. I was living by myself at that time. And so I kind of forgot about it. In an hour or so, a couple of hours after that, after I woke up, I got a call from this woman, and she said, well, how'd you like the rearrangement of the furniture in your house? I said, what are you talking about? And then she explained to me that she had an out-of-body experience that evening, late at night, around midnight, and she thought of me, and she suddenly found herself in my house. And she noticed that I was in the kitchen, and I was in the kitchen at that late hour, reading, and around midnight it was. And then she said she tried to, you know, make a gesture or something but I obviously was unaware of her presence. So she floated back into the living room and noticed the music stand. And she said she attempted to move it, thinking she might be able to and catch my attention. And don't ask me how she did this, but she succeeded in moving the music stand right into the center, and then spontaneously went back to her body and went to sleep and all that. And so I thought to myself, well, look, I mean, guess what? The music stand was moved.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, why would I think in the morning that I had moved my music stand? And why did she imagine that she, in other words, moved my music stand? It looks like that's what happened. Her story and my experience jived. And she described what I was doing in the other room, in the kitchen. So that was a knockout, because, you know, people have the out of body experiences, but they don't necessarily come back from the experience with anything that they can say that proves they were really there on the spot. In this case, she saw my house, she saw me, what I was doing, and she produced a physical effect to move an object, which is what convinced me that what she was telling me was a true story. So that was a knockout type of experience. I myself have had a few minor, brief out-of-body experiences, striking enough to be remembered, but nothing as dramatic as the account that I just reported to you.
I have had an experience.
So that story.
In terms of that, and somebody wrote on your blog about Bob Monroe, and he talks about how he, when he was out of body, he was able to touch an associate. She was playing cards or at a table with some other people, and he pinched her and was able to make contact. I asked my husband, because he was a kid, my husband was able to do these things for a certain period of time. And at one point, he and his sister brought back a flower and left it on the couch, and he was so upset with her because she wasn't supposed to touch anything or bring anything back. And then their mom for years didn't know what happened until they fessed up. And the other thing was that when I re-met him after 30 years of going different directions, he said something about doing flying, and I said, well, so can you visit me when you fly? And he visited me and touched my nose in the middle of the night, and I knew it was him, and I was like, okay, yeah, I guess you have better control over it. So,
wow, okay, yeah.
So, yeah, so these things happen. These things happen.
They do, and I have had reports of ghostly events. For example, I had a student once who told me that something would come into her room at night and pull the covers off her. It was like an ongoing, innocuous kind of a haunting. It didn't terrify her in any way, but there were physical events. You see that I don't recall her saying that she was ever touched. Although I did have another story. I find this story really weird and amusing, of a guy. And again, I can't vouch. I was not there. I can only say these people did not strike me as being outright liars.
Right.
But this one gentleman told me that he was entering a closet once in his house and he was by himself, when a hand came down on his back, and when he turned around, there's nobody there, and he heard a voice telling him that he was going to die, and gave a time, and then, I don't remember the time, so I'm not going to make it up just to make the story sound true. I'm only going to repeat the part that I remember. And then he said, no, not then. And he gave another date. And the guy never died as a result of this, but this may have just been a kind of obnoxious ghost that wanted to scare somebody. I don't know.
A prankster.
I've heard a lot of stories where there are physical effects of ghostly intrusions.
Okay. So, well, this is it's a very normal part of my life. When I went to Sagebrush Inn, I believe it is, in Taos, there were a couple of experiences. And one had to do with the dog being absolutely petrified when we came back from breakfast. The dog was just beside herself trying to get under the covers in the bed. The TV was on. We had not turned the TV. There's no way she could have turned it on. It wasn't something that she could have touched. But the other thing about that was during the night, I woke up and I noticed that my husband had his arm across me. And I was just thinking, okay, and woke up and I looked and I noticed. And then I went back to sleep. And in the morning, I woke up and I realized it wasn't his arm, because this arm had it had all sorts of hair on it. And in the middle of the night, I hadn't thought anything about it because I wasn't anticipating something different. And that's when I remembered that wasn't. And I told him, and he hadn't even turned toward me, because we were in one of these king size beds, so he wasn't there. And that's there are lots of things like that. For me, that I know that there are other things that are very real that we just haven't got a clue about at this point, because it's in a different, for us, dimension. And as we get more, I think, more savvy at this stuff, we'll allow that we need to upgrade our awareness. That makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, while you were telling me your story, Wendy, I've remembered something else. I've had so many experiences. I haven't written them all up, but let me, and this is brief, and similar to what you just described in some ways. I was lying in bed one night, asleep, and again, this period in my life when I was by myself, and that's important for what I'm about to say. Suddenly, my back is sort of facing the wall in the bed, and suddenly I feel something got into bed with me, and it was heavy because the bed sank.
Yeah.
And I started, my back was to the force that was lowering the thing that was there, and I kind of was hesitant to turn. I wanted to look, but I heard a kind of a groan, this heavy thing right next to me, breathing in a weird way, and I did not turn to look to see what was there, but waited a second or so, and gradually I felt it lift off the bed and disappear, and then I had the guts to turn around and look, and there was nothing there, needless to say. Again, it woke me up. it could have been a dream, you know, could have been a dream, but I would swear that it was not.
You know better. That's the thing about
exactly.
This.
I'm the judge of my own experience.
Yes. Yeah. And that I find in a lot of these cases, when people know their own reality, and because of the social stigma of this isn't supposed to happen, we are still having to, you know, make explanations and justify. And you automatically said, "Oh, I unconsciously moved the stand," and you knew that didn't make sense, and yet that would make it okay if that happened instead of the other. I think hopefully this is the teenage growing pains we're going through right now.
maybe, but there's a long history of resistance to the phenomena that we're talking about ever since, but particularly since the rise of the scientific revolution, where scientists have undoubtedly advanced our understanding of physical reality, and we know all kinds of things now that we didn't know, let's say, prior to the 17th century. But the error here is the assumption that the scientists have made that because they have mastered a deep understanding of physical reality, they have, many, not all, have arrived at the incorrect conclusion that everything must be physical. Just because they know more about the physical world, they have made the assumption, I'm being rather vague about, you know, scientists in general, but they tend to believe that the only thing that's real is what they're accustomed to dealing with, measuring and testing, and that is the physical. But that doesn't follow, because we not only are physical realities, we are mental realities. And anyone who doesn't understand that has not paid enough attention to their own selves, you see. I mean, look inside of yourself. The things that you experience and see, your memories, your dreams, your feelings, your fantasies, the imagery that floats through your mind any moment, all of that is entirely different in its nature than anything physical. Of course, the scientists and some psychologists, behaviorists try to say, oh, no, those things are illusions. The only real thing is your brain. But,
well, I think that's Western.
There's lots of arguments.
That's a Western, I think. I think that's a Western construct, Because I do think that some of the other cultures, you know, whether it's Indian or Asian, they have a much greater sense of a reality and other things that are non-corporeal that the scientists are still struggling with, you know. And I don't know. Well, Nikola Tesla, the thing that he talked about, saying that once science starts studying the non-physical phenomena, we'll make a whole lot more progress, you know, in decades rather than centuries. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, still stands.
Yeah, I agree. But even you mentioned India. Back in 1995, there was this milk miracle all over, for one day, all over India. And, there's this statue of the god Ganesha. And people would bring, normally, they bring milk. And they feed it, and it just goes into a little pan. Mm-hmm. On this one day, the milk disappeared all over, all over the world, wherever there are Indian temples. And one of my students went to heard about this thing, and went to a temple and went online twice to prove it. To himself, that it was real, the phenomenon. I witnessed it on BBC. Had a reporter in a temple in London, and he brought this teaspoon of milk, put it under the mouth of the statue, and you could see it disappear. It slowly evaporated into nothingness. Now, this thing caused the stock market in Bombay to stop. All the milk. They ran out of milk all over India for that day. And guess what? The scientists decided that it was mass hysteria.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, thousands, if not millions of people witnessed this thing. So, you know, you have the scientific blowhards who know the know-it-alls in, you know, in all cultures nowadays. And I think that, you know, it's a mistake that they need to wake up and realize that there are more things in heaven and earth, as Hamlet said, than are dreamt of in our philosophies.
There was a miracle in this 1877. I can't remember what 99 years ago. So that a miracle, the sun UFO sighting, and this was in Fatima, Portugal, and
that's another
They believe
phenomenon. Yeah,
they believe it could have been UFO because of the discs that were that all of these people said they saw, and now the paintings. You know, there's stuff going on here that's just saying, wake up, you know, grow up, expand.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
So okay, so
I you don't hear too. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, go back to your book. Well, we got away from levitation.
Hey, sure,
we got away from levitation. I think you've covered a lot of territory the way you've analyzed it and laid it out and gone through chapter by chapter and giving footnotes and giving background for people to really go through and examine how this fits our current state of consciousness. I think it's fantastic that there is this kind of documentation to validate his experience. What he was going through, and he leaves breadcrumbs for anybody who's interested in following it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I have another book, by the way, on St. Joseph coming out. It should be out pretty soon. This will be his biography, which is full of, you know, interesting stories. And further commentary of me. What I try to do in the new book is suggest that Joseph is like a template. If you look at his life and all the phenomena, mysticism, the ecstasy, all the different, the healing phenomena, you could think of him as a template for the possible evolution of the species, of the human species. I mean,
Absolutely.
He's just one case. I mean, and you know, there are many others, but maybe it's more accurate to say that all of these phenomena represent a template for the future evolution of humankind. But
he
I pick him because people like the stories.
Oh,
So that's one way of looking at it.
Well, how soon is that coming out?
It's in the hands of a publisher that I think is going to publish it. So by the end of this year, I hope.
Okay.
Sooner, maybe soon.
Excellent. Well, I'd love to talk with you more, and I want to, we'll talk with you more about that. But if you are listening right now, the book that we're just now talking about is absolutely fantastic. It will give you some more ideas about what's going on around you, and that, this has been going on for quite some time. It isn't just immediate. The Flying, The Man Who Could Fly. And then the blog that you do is Consciousness Unbound on Blogspot. So you can check out Michael Grosso's blog there. And do you still teach, or are you freelancing? What are you up to?
No. I'm just writing now, and I hang out with these researchers in Charlottesville who do research on reincarnation and near-death experience. No, I'm not teaching. I just write and do research.
Jim Tucker.
Sorry.
Jim Tucker?
Oh, yeah, Jim Tucker and Bruce Grayson, Ed Kelly, all of these fine scholars who are breaking open the world's consciousness with this interesting research. I'm interested in the extreme phenomena of saints and yogis.
We'll talk to you again soon, okay? Michael Grosso, thanks for listening.
All right. Okay.